Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Francisco.
It's good to see you again. Where are we going today?
Well, I knew that this week I wanted to talk about World Mental Health Day, which falls each year on October 10th. So that was Sunday. The World Health Organization started World Mental Health Day in an effort to bring about awareness to the need for better access to mental health care. And with the pandemic, we've seen this meteoric rise in need for better access to mental health care, especially in areas where people didn't generally suffer with mental health issues or mental health concerns. But with the pandemic, they found themselves experiencing depression and anxiety and panic attacks in ways that they had never experienced before. And we saw this everywhere from frontline workers to teachers, to childcare providers, to parents, but then also in a really vulnerable population, a population that tends to have some of the higher rates of mental health concerns, and those were adolescents, teenagers, and young adults. And so I knew that was where I wanted to spin today, especially because I've seen this continued rise in need for mental health care on campus, or as students are returning on campus. I've seen it in my classes for the last five quarters. And what's been a little surprising to me is that even with the returning to on-campus classes, and I'm teaching virtually this quarter for one more quarter, but in my classes, I continue to see rising rates of requests for extensions on papers or excused absences or just wanting to stay after class and chat or coming to my office hours. And part of me thought that as we kind of moved back to some level of functioning, that the needs of the students would start to level out. But instead of actually having more requests and more concerns and more students struggling this quarter than any previous quarter in the last 10 years, but especially since the pandemic started. And so that has been a surprise for me. And also I've receive phone calls from family members that I don't hear from that often, who are feeling incredibly worried about their teenagers, who are struggling and not doing well with their adjustment back to campus, failing their grade in class, failing grades in class, feeling hopeless, feeling uninspired, not sure where to move forward. And so there's definitely this theme that has emerged that those who are the most vulnerable when it comes to mental health issues, the highest rate of suicide in our society are those 15 to 34. So we already see that adolescents and young adults, you know, really live on the edge of mental wellness. Currently, 24.5% of those of college age students are taking some form of mood stabilizer, and 95% of college counselors who reported to the American Psychological Association report that mental health issues are growing on campus right now. And along with that, we're seeing other stories emerge around the country that are really, in some ways, disheartening, but also not a surprise. And one of them that I read yesterday was about the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Their chancellor decided to cancel classes today in response to multiple suicides over the last couple of months and an attempted suicide report. And the chancellor decided that they needed to call for a wellness day, kind of in response to Sunday's Mental Health Day, World Mental Health Day. He called for a wellness day, encouraging his students to check in with each other and check in with themselves, and to kind of take a community wellness check because things have become so dire on campus. And so again, you would think we're trying to return back to some level of functioning that we were before the pandemic, and yet this transition really isn't going well for a lot of students, a lot of young people, and a lot of professionals outside of the school arena. There was another article that came out in the Bay Area in the San Jose Mercury News that said 56% of residents of Silicon Valley, although things are returning to some level of normal, are feeling like things are not better for them and that they're actually looking to try to leave the Bay Area because they've decided to reprioritize what they value in life, their work-life balance, their mental health, their family relationships over making a living. So they're all interconnected. My brain is going in this interconnected place because the pandemic hit and everyone wanted to get back to normal as quickly as possible, right? A lot of outcry, let's get kids back on campus, let's get schools functioning, let's get people back to work. And yet, as we've made steps to getting back to work or getting people back on campus, there's been a growing cry that this isn't going well, that the transition back to what we wanted, work, school, our lives the way it used to be, isn't really going as we'd hoped or what people expected, that going back to work isn't really what people want. They don't want to go back to work in the way that work used to be. And students are coming back to campus. They don't want to come back to campus to an environment that wasn't really working for them before the pandemic. You know, the level of stress and anxiety that college students were reporting previous to the pandemic, worried about grades, worried about keeping up with the workload, worried about the sexual assault and rape culture on many campuses, those issues that were already a problem for students prior to the pandemic are still there. And so now students are transferring back to college and realizing, wait, there are things about that college life that weren't working before. And now you pile on top of that, the pandemic stress. I don't know if I want to come back to that. And 67% of students are not returning back to college in the way that they did before because of their mental health reasons, for their life concerns. And so there's something that needs to be addressed that has to do with mental health, but to focus strictly on individual mental health as being the issue, this idea that if we can just get everyone onto the BetterHelp app, or if we can get everyone into a counselor, it's going to take care of this pandemic of mental health illness or issues right now. But that's looking too narrowly at the issue. It's not about throwing more people into mental health care services, although good support would be helpful. But what's really needing to be addressed is, what are the quality of life issues that need to be changed, addressed, altered, so that the life that people are transitioning back to is more supportive to good mental health? And I have some ideas about how we get there. And I have some ideas about why people are struggling to go back to what they so desperately said they wanted, which was get the kids in school, get us back to work, get life and the economy functioning. Why isn't it the panacea that people hoped it would be once we came through this? I have some ideas. And I've invited one of my favorite guests on today to kind of bring another generational perspective. My friend Kyle Berlin, who is a Princeton graduate. He's also an Aurora Grande High School graduate. But a Princeton graduate, and he's just finished a fellowship in Ireland. And so he's seen some things in his 20 plus years on the planet. And so I wanted to have him come in and talk a bit about his experience, kind of this moving out into the world right before the pandemic, and then kind of living through that pandemic experience and what that looks like now. So I'm excited to see where the conversation takes us today. I always enjoy getting to have Kyle on the air. And although we won't be able to take calls as normal, you will be able to call in with questions or comments, and Francisco will be happy to share them with us. And Francisco, can you remind everyone of that phone number for calling in and sharing a comment or question?
Yeah, that phone number is going to be 805-549-8855, and we will take your call as a question, and then I'll read it on air. And yeah, so give us a call, 805-549-8855, or toll-free 800-549-8855.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break and I'm going to gather my thoughts a little bit, and we'll be back to start our conversation with Kyle Berlin about where do we go post-pandemic in a way that's going to be more supportive to the lifestyle and life opportunities that we also desperately want and desire. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist.
I'm still thinking about your beautiful face.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Thanks for tuning in today. And as I mentioned, I came into the show this week saying I really want to address World Mental Health Day, but I want to address World Mental Health Day not as much through the lens of the individual and the individual struggles that we're seeing at epidemic levels, pandemic levels of people that are reaching out and saying, this is just not working for me. My life is not going well. And the increase in suicide since the pandemic began in a population that already has the highest level of suicidal ideation in our society, and those are those 15 to 34. And the increase in concerns about mental health and mental wellness for those that are returning back to work or looking for childcare for their children, that the transmission back to something isn't going well. And our mental health is suffering greatly for it. But I think we're looking in some ways in the wrong direction. And so I was grappling last night, like, I'm not sure how to address this because I don't want to do another show just about a crisis. I don't want to do another show just saying, yes, we are in this together and this is terrible. And it doesn't look like we have any easy ways out. And so I was trying to think about how do we come into today's show with something that's hopeful? Like, what are the tools we can use? And then this happened. So last night, and I might have told you already, but my husband and I are in Montana on Flathead Lake. And was very excited about the Giants win last night. And so I had a hard time falling asleep. And I was kind of laying there and it was a crystal clear sky and the stars are pretty amazing. And there was this glow off in the horizon. And so I woke up my husband. I said, I think that that's Northern Lights off in the northern horizon from our house. And he's like rolled over and it's freezing outside. It was in the 20s. And I said, really, come out here. And sure enough, last night, we had the most incredible Northern Lights experience right off the deck of our house because of an electromagnetic storm that came through. And I've never experienced anything like that. And I was, if you know the reference, I was the double rainbow man of the Northern Lights experience last night. And this feeling of something so much greater than myself, this reminder of the world is so incredible. And this sense of awe that I felt, that it was so amazing to be alive, that I forgot how cold I was. I forgot how sad I've been and worried for my students and worried for family members and worried for, you know, those who are trying to get back to work and each other. It's like the overall worries that I feel have been so heavy. And I have personally been feeling this kind of tension in my back and this heaviness in my body for a long time. Was alleviated last night as I danced around like a loon on my deck, yelling at my husband till he finally came out wrapped in some sort of down blanket. And we just took this sight in. It was incredible. And so I woke up this morning, I thought, that's it. That's what needs to be happening, is that we have to get outside of this bubble of pain and misery in some way and find moments of awe. And it doesn't have to be something like the Northern Lights, although I will say, it was incredible. But awe can come in many forms. And I think when we're feeling depressed or anxious or overwhelmed or beleaguered, that we forget that there are things outside of our immediate world that are awe-inspiring. And those feelings of awe make being alive a gift. And when we can feel like being alive is a gift, we can start to develop the resilience to make our way through really challenging times. So I want you to think about awe and where you might have experienced that. So Kyle Berlin, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Elizabeth. It's good to talk to you again.
And so because we have the magic of Zoom between us, I'm talking to you from Montana. Francisco's in San Luis Obispo. And where are you today?
Well, I'm freshly arrived in New York City. So if you hear any background noise, that's just the sound of the human parade going by in Manhattan.
Absolutely. And so I'm so glad you're here. We'll do a little catch up, and then I want you to be thinking about awe, because one of the reasons that I texted you this morning and said, hey, can you come be a guest on the show, is because over the last few years, you've been on a journey of explorations once you graduated from Princeton and set out into the world. And when you send me Snapchats, which isn't often, but when you send them, they're always of some dramatic landscape, some place that you're visiting that gives me this sense of awe and beauty. And I'm so happy that you're experiencing these places. And I thought, I wonder if Kyle's purposely curating these places of awe, or if he's just sending off a Snapchat. And so I wanted to start there. Is that what inspires your Snapchat messages to those in your family circle? And is there a sense of awe in your travels?
Well, thanks for that question. I will say, you know, my Snapchat circle is pretty small. So I count you among the inner circle, and I'm pretty rare in my Snapchat sending. I think I do send when I'm just sort of so moved by something or by a site or experience that I want to share it with those who I'm closest to. And I think that's, you know, that's ultimately the kind of best impulse that our social media is able to inspire in us. Of course, we could talk forever about the more negative impulses, but that's what I love to share. And because these experiences and these places are moving me so much, I feel that they're, as you just described with the Northern Lights, I feel that they're changing my experience of being alive in a really profound way. And so to even provide just a snap glimpse of that is important to me. So I'll say briefly, you know, I was just in Ireland for the last year on this fellowship that you mentioned, and there's this old Celtic idea, this old Irish idea of thin spaces, where the veil between this world and the next world, you know, whether you want to call it the divine world or the, you know, there's lots of different things you could call it, but the sort of spiritual, when that veil becomes thin, the old Celtic tradition calls that a thin space. And you kind of have a deeper sense of time and being in the world. And so I feel I'm constantly searching for those places, and that's what propels me to keep moving.
And so just to give some context also to the conversation, you know, part of your studies at Princeton and with your fellowship have been around this idea of melancholy and melancholia and dark spaces and kind of reveling sometimes in the darker, deeper parts of life. But I think in a way that can also keep us stuck in that darker space of life. So what did you come up with? Where have you found yourself as far as, you know, doing those studies, doing the fellowship, and what has it propelled you to want to do moving forward?
That's a great question. Thank you. To be honest, I was sort of propelled towards melancholia and studying this as a kind of academic or artistic realm because it was so much a part of my own sort of personal emotional experience of just being alive and feeling, you know, sadness or feeling a certain way about being in the world. And then the more I kind of leaned into that and read what other people have written about it or art that people have created and was able to talk to people who have devoted their life to, you know, interrogating these feelings, I discovered that I was actually able to kind of, I don't know if take control is the word, but have a kind of sense of my own sort of emotional commitment to a certain set of feelings. So I can sort of decide, oh, at this point, I'm feeling melancholic. I'm feeling that wash over me. And I can either indulge that because it's a type of pleasure, or I can say, you know, I just want this to wash over me and I want to, you know, move on in the best way that's possible. So I don't know. I once thought that it would sort of dominate my life. It seemed like there would be no escape from this feeling. And in a certain sense, that's true. But in another sense, I feel perhaps ironically kind of liberated to kind of determine which feelings I'm choosing to indulge in. Because I mean, I feel like you can't choose what washes over you, but you can choose what you want to focus on with your own. Maybe I'm getting too philosophical, but this is, anyway, that's kind of my, that's kind of how I've been thinking about it recently. And I really just enjoy talking to people about how they're feeling, because I think it opens up all these larger questions.
Well, and I think it's a great place to dive in here because, you know, statistically, and I was looking through the statistics from the American Psychological Association for 2021, expecting the spikes that I saw. But what stays consistent is that adolescents, teenagers, you know, right up until their early 20s, have the highest level of angst, I'll use that word, but highest levels of reported depression and anxiety. And in some ways, it goes hand in hand with that whole developmental process. Because if you think about adolescence, it's a period of popping all of the bubbles of our childhood, right? All the mysteries and magic of being a child, and then stepping slowly into the realm of adulthood, you know, passing into the realities of life, the cold, harsh realities. And so it would make sense that adolescents in those early 20s would have deeper, darker, melancholia type of experiences. And part of that process of coming through it would require normalizing emotions and teaching the skills and resilience to be able to allow things to flow over us, or else we get stuck in that space. And so when you have that kind of normal developmental phase, but then on compounding it, you put the pressure on adolescents and young 20-somethings to have all of their life figured out and to enter into a college environment or move into a work environment at, you know, 18 years old and take on these big, large life responsibilities of studying, passing tests, making life plans, can be crushing when you haven't even really stepped into a new understanding of who you are in the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And this is something you said to me a while ago that's really stuck with me, is this idea of going through a kind of, you know, a extended transitional period where you're not certain, you're on unstable ground. And that's part of being young. That's part of this time in life, you know, because often I felt like, what the heck? Well, you know, why am I still so uncertain? Why do I still feel all this doubt or all this melancholy or all this, you know, confusion? And that's just part of this phase of life. And it's a kind of a beautiful thing, I think, that allows you to explore and find different avenues for, you know, for what, not that you ever really land, you know, you never really make it, but thinking about this as being a, you know, a transitional moment for all of us really too. I think it provides a lot of opportunities for growth and being intentional about how we want to change the way that we're living.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Kyle Berlin from a coffee shop in downtown New York City. And we're talking about kind of the rise in mental health concerns through the pandemic and this experience of transitioning back. I don't even know if back's the right word, or transitioning into whatever life looks like now with returning to campus and masks and returning to work. But a lot of people are saying, I don't want to return to work if it means the quality and conditions that I had before the pandemic, you know, the poor pay and lack of accessibility to childcare and lack of health care for myself and my family. That people are really feeling resistant to step back into a life pattern that wasn't supporting their mental health and well-being and the mental health and well-being of those they love and are responsible for. So there's this almost stuck place that people are in of resisting moving back into what used to be their life and yet needing to move to something and not being sure what that is. And then also seeing that for college students as they move back to campus and in-person classes, not only is there that anxiety of how is it going to go, testing, masks, the uncertainty for the professors, but also jumping back into a culture that was not very supportive of their mental health and well-being prior to the pandemic. You know, you look at the list of primary causes for distress that students, college students talk about, and they include stress around school life and keeping up with school, financial anxiety, paying for student loans, paying for their education, feeling overworked with assignments and keeping work outside of school, a sedentary lifestyle on campus, but then also the traumatic events and impacts of things like sexual assault and racism that are common on college campuses. So students are feeling also that reluctance of, do I want to step back into that culture again? Even though I don't want to stay quarantined or isolated at my parents' house, I need to go somewhere, but is it to that campus? And I think that, Kyle, is what the World Health Organization and the mental health, they should be really talking about, not throwing more mental health services, but really helping people to redefine or change. I don't even know the answer, but this transition that people are stuck in because no one wants to go back to what was, but they're not really sure what's forward. And so what's forward for you right now?
Well, yeah, that is the question. I don't know if I really have an answer per se, but I do feel like I think part of what contributes to this is, you know, the sense that so many students have, and I think they're right about this, that the stakes are so high. I mean, the stakes for their own kind of life are so dependent upon their education and what they're able to achieve in their schooling years. And so they feel just a tremendous amount of pressure to perform and socially and academically in all these different ways. And there's not a lot of space culturally for, for a less frantic and less fraught kind of exploration, which is what I think the idea of college, or, you know, even if you don't go to college, your early 20s, young adulthood should be about. Of course, we could have, personally, I think this has a lot to do with our politics and how we live in an economy of precarity where, you know, it's where if you're unable to achieve economically, you're in a really precarious situation, but that's a whole different conversation. But I think that contributes to the people's mental stress as well, as just the economic difficulties of survival in this time. So I don't know. For me, I feel that I've kind of come to terms with continuing to explore different avenues of my own interests. You know, I have theater interests, I have activist interests, I have academic interests. So I'm kind of exploring all these in different ways and being all right with that exploration, rather than feeling like, even though I'm getting older now, I still don't have to land. You know, there is no arrival. There's a constant state of becoming. So I don't know, that's what I've been thinking about a little bit.
And I think that what I started off the show talking about, this capacity to see something outside of our purview, to be able to still be struck by awe and wonder, are those little baby steps. Because that's what I really wanted to explore for the second part of the show, is what are those baby steps? What are those actual tools we can use and put into action to help us make this move, this transition to whatever comes next? Because we can stay stuck. People spend years of their life being stuck in situations that they grouse about. You'll hear people, you know, complain forever about, I can't stay with this job, it's terrible. I can't stay with this marriage, it's terrible. I can't stay, you know, in this relationship. I mean, we hear this as a clinician. I hear this regularly, that we get to a place of feeling like our life is untenable, and yet we're frozen because we can't imagine anything else. And until we can imagine something else, we're going to be frozen in this current state of despair. And that doesn't matter where you fall in socioeconomic strata or the educational strata, you know, in society, that every one of us have to find places in our life, or we'll find ourselves in places in our life where we have to either admit that we're going to stay rooted and stuck, or make the painful small steps towards moving forward. And it's all premised on this idea that Murray Bowen, who is a pioneer in family systems therapy, gave us in the 1940s. He said, people will never change until the pain of staying the same becomes greater than the pain of change. And I think that's where we are right now, is in this moment of great suffering on all levels of society, in all demographics. There are great levels of suffering happening, but the pain has not become great enough in the suffering for people to actually take the steps towards change. Because all change, even the change that will make our lives fantastic, come at some sort of cost. And it comes at some sort of, it calls on us to have the ability to be courageous and to step into the unknown. And you talked about that veil of space. And we're in this moment where everyone is in this veil of space of saying, I've got to either walk through to a new normal, or I'm going to be stuck in this kind of neverland for a long, long time. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and nothing I like more than a little philosophical discussion on a Tuesday afternoon. And I'd love for you to call and share your thoughts or concern or question. Although we can't take them live over Zoom today, you can leave them with Francisco, and he'll be happy to share them with us over the air. Our number is 805-549-8855. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment to take your comments and questions and also to continue our conversation with Kyle Berlin. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Oh, and when the kids are old enough, we're going to teach them to fly. To the ground, not falling but rising like rolling around, eyes closed above the rooftops, eyes closed, we're gonna spin through the stars, our arms wide as the sky, we're gonna ride the blue all the way to the end.
You're listening to A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist, and we're inviting you to be part of this conversation. Give us a call at 800-549-8855, 805-549-8855, to ask your question to today's guest. Our conversation continues here. Elizabeth, back to you.
Thank you, Francisco. And so during the break, I was thinking, what is our topic today, Elizabeth? Where are we really going? And mostly, I'm thinking about transitions and awe. And I'm not sure how the two connect together, but I know that, as I mentioned earlier, dancing around on my deck last night, seeing the Northern Lights, which is something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, and feeling so overwhelmed and excited and happy to be alive, which I think has been a hit or miss feeling throughout the pandemic and throughout, really challenging times in my life, to feel so small and in awe is great mental health medicine. And the main thing I wanted to share, if I say nothing else in this hour, is to find those moments of awe. But we most especially need to help our children, the young adults in our lives, the teenagers in our life, the younger children in our lives, to help them experience moments of awe. For little kids, it's easier because they're in awe of everything. They see a spider and it's magic. They see cats or other sort of animals at the farm, and they're in awe of that. Everything for children gives them a sense of life as magic. But we tend to lose that going through our adolescent years, especially as kind of the veil of childhood is torn away and we step into the more, harsh realities of adulthood, which include getting some sort of education or training, finding work or a vocation, being able to, house ourselves and put food on the table and look for a partner. Like that's the work of life. But to be able to balance it with moments of feeling in awe of life itself is really essential to mental health. And I think in our efforts as a profession to provide services and to give people spaces to talk and to help to balance their mental health and well-being, that we forget that a lot of our remedies for our mental health exist right in the world around us. But part of the reason we get stuck in our mental health crises is because we stop having the capacity to get outside of our small purview and perspective and notice everything outside of us that is larger than we are, like that universal awe. And so resilience is a huge part of being able to overcome and withstand and live with the struggles of life, because we're never going to eradicate them. We always are going to have stressors, but to have the tools like resilience, being able to bounce back after hardships, to believe in something greater than ourselves, and that can be fueled by moments of awe. So that's, I think, the main message today. But along with that, how do we take those practical steps to transition back to what life is now and what it's going to be moving forward? A couple of weeks ago, my husband and I actually took the bold step to fly to Chicago to visit our younger daughter, Kelly, who's going to law school there. And just to add on to it, we went to Wrigley Field and saw two Dead & Co shows. Whole nother story, but again, feelings of awe to be in that musical environment. It was worth taking kind of that risk of traveling during the pandemic. And it again gave me this sense of being a part of something bigger than myself. But being with that many people after a year and a half was shocking. And so Kyle, you know, you're talking to me from a coffee shop in New York, and I'm wondering if you can resonate with that experience of this transitioning back to being in public.
Yes, totally. I mean, it's funny because I'm just sitting here, and the sound and the people passing by, it's so overwhelming. I've been around a little bit since the pandemic started, but nothing, I'd sort of forgotten just how kind of effervescent and overflowing life can be in an urban center like New York, especially. So it's been, on the one hand, yeah, I just got here, but it's a little overwhelming, as you said, because I'm just not used to being surrounded by so many people, and feeling, oh yeah, this is, on the one hand, this is a kind of return to something that I used to know and love, and then on the other hand, so many things are, you know, irrevocably changed, and things will not ever be the same again, not only sort of on a practical, logistical level with masks and vaccines and all these things, but also on a kind of interpersonal level, and how you relate to the people on the street or in a coffee shop, it's totally changed. And so I've been just, I don't know, I've been seeing a couple old friends and how lovely it is to do that, but also struggling a little bit with reintegration into a, you know, a much larger kind of tapestry of sociability. I guess, you know, we feed so much off other people, and it's strange when other people are still, you know, a threat in some way.
And I think that's the conundrum, is that we are social beings and we want to find our way back into community. And yet in a lot of ways, we've forgotten how that looks.
Totally. I mean, I have friends who were even, you know, much more isolated than I was. I was fortunate that I was for a while at this theater company, which was kind of one big pod. So we had our little social circle within our COVID pod. But there are people who I know who, you know, were extremely isolated the whole time. And you forget the kind of the ways of relation that become natural only after practice. And on the one hand, it's terrifying. On the other hand, I think, as we've been talking about, I think that provides an opportunity for transition to kind of potentially reimagining or rethinking the ways that we do relate. So I don't know, that's the hope that I'm holding on to, is that we'll have a kind of more, some sort of radical reawakening or rethinking about our modes of sociability and what we get and give to other people.
Well, and I think, you know, that goes along with a lot of the reluctance people are having about going back to their work life prior to the pandemic what that looked like, that because of the pandemic and isolation and working from home or, you know, changing family structures, the people are starting to reprioritize their personal wellness and their relationship to others and rethinking what it means to have a community. You know, maybe it isn't a community of a million people in a city, but it is that community of smaller pods. I mean, I don't know if that larger scale amount of socializing was ever really in our best interest.
Yeah. I think that there's, you know, a natural limit to how many people you can really relate to and be, you know, sustained by and give to in a robust way. So I think, yeah, a smaller circle in a lot of ways doesn't, it makes a lot of sense. I think the sort of, again, sorry if I'm tending towards the philosophical, but or the existential, but I think the larger question is, you know, if we are able to build these smaller circles of sociability, how then are we also able to build a kind of wider circle or wider network of care? Like, how are we able to not only do self-care for ourselves or for our immediate loved ones, but for a larger circle of people across difference and of all kinds? So I think that's the kind of political question, but one that this moment is definitely asking for us, posing for us as well.
So I don't know if I have an answer for it, but off the top of my head, I would think that my bias would be towards more community healthcare, that instead of trying to have larger entities that provide healthcare, mental health care, that we actually make it smaller, that we have a tighter community that we look out for and that we're responsible for. You know, I use this line in my classes all the time, and I ask my students, what if your only responsibility was to create a life that supported your mental health and well-being and the mental health and well-being of those you love and are responsible for? How would you live differently? And I really feel like the pandemic and this space that we're in of not, you know, between two worlds is bringing that to the surface, that a lot of people are saying, I want to prioritize my mental health and well-being and my quality of relationships with those in my small circle, that maybe this retreat a bit from the grandiose social life, you know, the social world and large institutional healthcare and large institutional public school systems, maybe that isn't the perfect way that humans interact and relate with each other. Maybe that was too isolating. And maybe part of this transition is to smaller groups of community care that are more personal.
Oh, I agree 100%. I think that it's a wonderful vision. I think it's what so many people are searching for and thirsting for. And this kind of, I think it's, you know, this notion of we take care of ourselves and within a community is a wonderful sort of, again, a kind of political aspiration as well. It comes at the same time as, you know, across the American landscape and much of the world, it's really the kind of, a lot of the big conglomerates that are dominating, right? Like, there's just, you know, the disappearance of mom and pops or all these, you know, in favor of Amazon or whatever. It's just kind of the largest are able to survive. And still, but I do think that there's always kind of, you know, like mushrooms pop up from the forest floor. There are always these kind of sanctuaries of care and community that do emerge despite tremendous odds. And I think it's to those that we can look for inspiration and awe in a certain sense too.
Yes, in awe of that. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And listening to my guest, Kyle Berlin. And Francisco, did we have a call?
Yeah, we actually had a comment from Linda, who says it's a great show, but does mention that the awesomeness of the Aurora Borealis reminds her that while it is an awesome sight to behold, most people don't have that privilege to sit out and look around at the Aurora Borealis. So she kind of just called it and want to bring that topic to the forefront, just mentioning the privilege that comes with being able to observe the Aurora Borealis and, you know, in that natural phenomenon. But, you know, does emphasize it is a great show.
Well, thank you, Linda. But, and I absolutely appreciate that, because I am heartily aware of this opportunity to be able to be in this space, but I also want to, emphasize that awe can happen in really simple spaces in our own backyard or walking down the street, you know, taking the time to notice the natural phenomena that happen around us. If you go to our Instagram page or our Facebook page, I actually posted a picture of a spider that I happened to snap a picture of the other day. And it blows me away when I look at the spider. It looks like it has huge eyes. And this sense of childlike awe in the simple things of life are part of that remedy to our mental health, to this feeling overwhelmed and burdened by what's happening outside of us. I don't know how else to express it, that part of this work that we have as human beings is to look out for those in our community and also care for ourselves, and then be also mindful that not everyone has the same opportunities. But I think, I guess part of the overall for me, even as I'm saying that, is that that's where I think we get into trouble, is that I don't know if our psyches were really built to handle the trauma and loss and grief of the entire world, and to try to carry that on us and to hold that can be crippling. And to have that awareness is important on one level, but also for our own mental health and the well-being of those that we care for and are responsible for, we have to in some ways have this protective shield from all of the life's traumas that can cause us to feel desperate. And one of the pieces of research that's come up about Gen Z, this generation that's coming up right now, that part of the reason that their mental health has been so precarious in greater numbers than generations before them is because this is the first generation that has been bombarded with 24/7 news and information and contact with trauma and loss and sadness and climate change and inequities and from around the world. And it's crushing their souls. It's crushing their psyches. I don't know, Kyle, am I just trying to brush this off or push this aside?
No, I think it's a very live question. I think you're grappling with it well. And I think the caller brings up, you know, a very fundamental and good point. I think ultimately the way I think about it is that there's not, I think a lot about everyday space and ordinary time. You know, what we're doing in the space of the everyday, in our ordinary lives. You know, most people are having to go to work, get up, go to work all day at a job that they may not like, in order to pay the bills and, you know, make ends meet at the end of the month. That's the majority of this country and, you know, and the world. And so within that routine, which is maybe not ideal, what are the things that you're able to tap into? What are the joys and the pleasures, and what moments of awe are you able to glean from ordinary life? And I think it requires the development of a certain way of looking, of a certain set of sensibilities and senses and sensitivities to the beauty and wonder of things in everyday world. I mean, I'm right now looking at this pigeon, which is kind of, you know, a flying rat, as some people would call it, but it's really quite a beautiful bird. With the colors and the way that it's pecking itself. I mean, this is not gonna like make my life better on a material level, but it is also make me feel glad to be alive in this moment. And that, you know, on a personal level, I'll just say, if I may, it's strange because I feel that I'm drawn, as are you, Elizabeth, to these kind of grand moments of overwhelming awe and beauty in which you kind of are just able to let yourself go, whether it's the aurora borealis or the Grand Canyon or whatnot. And so that's one type of awe, but then there's also this awe that is accessible in the course of the everyday. And I think that is actually the kind of awe that is necessary to sustain the will to keep living against all this difficulty. And, my full-time job now is I work with the ACLU on immigration. And so I'm interacting with a lot of people who have incredibly difficult lives. And I often wonder, what are their where do they get the sustenance to go on? And I've been able to talk to some of them about that. And, you know, a lot of them find that that in faith, in belief in higher power, but also in the beauty of their family, or, you know, the beauty in a better possible world that they want to make for themselves. So I think that that's part of it too.
And I think that is kind of full circling back around to this idea of what are our options for maintaining our mental health and well-being. You know, on one hand, we can say it's an institutional issue that our government should be providing more care for us and we should have more facilities available. And the other hand, you know, as we move back into some functioning of our society and our economic world, what are our personal responsibilities and how much can we take back and take charge and take control of our lives so that we can protect our mental health and well-being? And I think that that's part of the resistance that a lot of people are feeling towards going back to campus, right? Going back to classes, going back to work in the conditions that they were working in before, that they may not feel like there's a lot of other options, but they know that what was happening before was not sustainable for their wellness. And so everyone is trying to kind of hold their ground in the hopes that some other better opportunity or plan becomes available. And as I said, I don't have an answer for that, but I feel like that's a collective experience that a lot of people are having, a reluctance to move back to something that was not okay.
Well, and I think that desire, even if it's, you know, even if we don't have an answer for what it looks like exactly, that feeling, I think that feeling is important in itself, because it points towards, you know, a better possible world. We're told that this is the only way it can be, that this is, you know, our fate to feel this way or to be in these conditions. But in fact, there are 1,001 alternatives, and it's kind of up to our collective will to shape those alternatives for ourselves and for each other. Anyway, so I want to say something for that desire, even if it doesn't have an answer or doesn't know what it looks like practically, because I think people are onto something when they feel that.
Well, and I think for the people that you're working with, in some ways, they're far more advantaged than those that are kind of here and have the privilege of being able to, you know, look for work or go to college. But for your clients, they're being driven by hope and a vision and the sense of awe that there is something greater for their lives. And I think many people are just feeling hopeless and stuck because they don't see anything on the horizon. There is no place for them to move towards or go to. And so the only other option then is to turn inward or to our smaller communities to try to shape meaning.
Right. I mean, I think we live in a pretty hopeless system that can feel pretty hopeless. There aren't necessarily a lot of options for people who are, and especially people who are, you know, like I'm working with, who are in situations where the laws are just opposed to them and opposed to their existence. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's definitely something to be said for that kind of the collective striving towards something better. But I think it's something that, you know, that anyone is able to tap into if given, you know, if gifted even, you know, just a relationship or some sort of perspective that would allow them to make themselves work themselves towards a certain feeling or certain goal. And I don't know. It's very difficult. I have no idea. I don't have an answer, but I guess that's what we're talking about. And I think that's why the feeling of awe can be so satisfying and fulfilling too, because you really feel when you're enraptured in something, just the utter overwhelm, both in a wonderful way, but also in this terrible way of, oh my gosh, it's all just so much. And feeling that authentically is, can be terrifying, but also I think it's the closest thing that we have to actually feeling like what it is to be alive right now in, you know, late capitalist 21st century America or wherever you are.
And I like that. I want to kind of close it up with that idea, because the alternative to taking time to pay attention to the details of life, you know, the magic of a child's face, or finding a unique spider, or a sunset, or, you know, how water ripples, all of those simple things, learning to indulge in those tangible parts of life is really fundamental to maintaining our mental wellness. And I think instead, as a society, we've fallen towards numbing ourselves to feeling anything at all, because there's so much great pain in the world and so much loss and frustration and grief that we tend to want to shut down and not have to experience those negative feelings or see those negative sights or be overwhelmed with those negative realities. And so we numb out. We watch too much television. We drink too much, right? We sleep too much. We eat too much to numb the feelings. And really the remedy for the overwhelm is to dive into life and feel the beauty, or allow ourselves to feel the beauty as often as we can. But when we shut down and shut down, we close off the possibilities that we can actually experience and feel the beauty. And I think that's what I was trying to relate last night, is that, you know, my work is in helping people, working with people and hearing their stories and being a part of their lives. And it carries a lot of weight to it, which I gladly take on because I feel like that's my role. But at the same time, that heaviness needs to be balanced. And having an experience last night woke me up to the fact that I think I'd been numbing out because there's so much pain. And it was a kick in my fanny to remind me that there are things greater than myself, and that I could take the weight of the world off my shoulders for a moment and just revel in some awe. And that felt like the best medicine I'd had in a long time. And so that's why I wanted to share it. And Kyle, I'd love sharing this hour with you, and I wish that we were having coffee next to each other.
Me too, Elizabeth. Thank you for letting me participate, and it was a pleasure to talk to you in the middle of this crazy city.
I love knowing that you're busy. I love it knowing that you're sharing yourself and your good works with other people. So thank you for being part of the show. And thank you to everyone for tuning in today and being part of the conversation. You can join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or on Instagram if you'd like to leave a comment or a message, or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. We'll be back again next Tuesday at 2 for a conversation about dementia and Alzheimer's and a growing concern in our society. As always, I appreciate you being part of this community and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett.
Saxophone, yeah. Buck jumping down on a boulevard. I couldn't wait to blow my own horn. Ooh. It ain't wrong for you to play along. Playing this song till you die. Come on, come on.
In this world with a lot.
Salt. Mm. We fell in love on the boulevard. If you was Jenny, I guess I was far. Run. Now it ain't wrong for you to sing along. Singing this song till you die.